You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on April the 29th, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know in the next 24 hours. Our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now on the line from Tokyo. Kenji, what do you have for us today?
Well, we'll be looking at South Korean workers leaving a joint North-South industrial complex and Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's trip to Russia.
Thanks very much indeed, Kenji. Also ahead, it only took them 2 months, but this weekend, Italy swore in a grand coalition government. We'll find out who's tasked with sorting out the chaos, and we'll ask how long they'll last.
And we'll find out why the Queen is celebrating a big win at the Theatre World's glitzy Olivier Awards.
And in this week's preview of Culture, we'll head to Los Angeles to explore a beautiful house in the Hollywood Hills.
This is a kind of a new turn, this idea of escaping from the white cube of the gallery or the museum. Somehow you have to respond to the house, you have to respond to the environment, give like more kind of boundaries to the artists, but at the same time, maybe become more creative.
So all that, plus we play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
First though, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines now from Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. A senior US senator has said that a group of nations should get troops ready to invade Syria in order to secure possible stocks of chemical weapons. The Arizona Senator John McCain, who was the Republican presidential candidate in 2008, said US troops should not go into Syria, but he said an international force must be ready operationally to go in and prevent Islamic militants involved in the civil war from getting their hands on chemical weapons.
We have said that they need a no-fly zone, which could be obtained without using U.S. manned aircraft. We could use Patriot missiles, Patriot batteries and cruise missiles to take out their air and to supply the resistance with weapons. And as you know, flood of weapons is coming in from Russia and Iran. Iranians are on the ground in Syria, and it's an unfair fight.
A human rights lawyer who represents 17 Guantanamo Bay detainees says the number of inmates on hunger strike has risen to nearly 130. David Ream says the US military had previously denied any hunger strike, but has now acknowledged that it is happening.
It's interesting because gradually, week by week and day by day, the Gitmo authorities have been acknowledging higher and higher numbers to the point where now they are acknowledging that 100 men are on hunger strike. We said about 130, and 20 are being force-fed, including one of my clients that I know about. And it's only gotten worse.
The parents of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects have abandoned plans to travel to the U.S. to see their surviving son. Jokhar Tsarnaev's father, Anzor, told Reuters that he and his wife have retreated to a village in southern Russia to avoid the limelight. He also said he didn't think he'd be allowed to see his son and repeated his belief that he and his dead brother, Tamerlan, were not guilty of the bombings. The Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan has condemned last week's attack on the French embassy as an attack on Libya and its leadership. He said there was no doubt that those responsible wanted to stop Libya's progress. He vowed that the government would not surrender to anyone and that the country would return to what it was before Colonel Gaddafi came to power in 1969. On Sunday, gunmen surrounded the foreign ministry, calling for officials who worked for Gaddafi to be banned from holding senior positions in the new administration. 10 seamen are missing after two cargo ships collided off southwestern Greece. All the missing men are from one of the ships, which sank. The other ship was not seriously damaged in the collision, which took place about 75 nautical miles off the island of Sapienza. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte says a monarch is important for national continuity and allows people to confront the real government. He was speaking after a news conference in Amsterdam to welcome international media ahead of Queen Beatrix's abdication and the investiture of her son, Crown Prince Willem-Alexander, on Tuesday. After a 33-year reign, Queen Beatrix will abdicate on the day she traditionally celebrated her birthday, leaving leadership to her eldest son. Although Willem-Alexander will have no formal political role, Rutte said the importance of the monarchy shouldn't be dismissed.
And I believe the Dutch monarchy, the House of Orange, it represents continuity. The House of Orange is connected to Dutch society for over 500 years, even when we were a republic. They were holding the highest offices in the state, in the land. And since 1813, the House of Orange is also giving us our kings and queens. So it is continuity, and at the same time, it makes people more open and more willing to confront the real government.
The future, we are frequently told, is bright. The future is orange. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. And it indeed will be a very orange sea of people in Holland tomorrow and later today as well for those Queen's Day, future King's Day celebrations.
It will be great fun. I think it will be marvellous. We're fired up on Monocle Cafe Coffee this morning, Phil Hahn, aren't we?
It's given us the kickstart we need. It's delicious.
Bright, sunny morning in London. The Chiltern Street Cafe is open on in Marylebone.
We were saying there was something in the air today, isn't there? Apart, you know, for a Monday morning, we're doing pretty well.
We're still alive. Let's see what happens in 54 minutes time, shall we? The time is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. It's just coming up to 16:07 in Tokyo, 8:07 a.m. here in London. You're with Midori House, live from Studio One. Time now to get ready and set the day's agenda, choosing three big stories you need to know about for the next 24 hours.
And today we're joined by our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, live from our Tokyo bureau. Kenji, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Let's start things off in South Korea, shall we?
Sure. South Korea has just pulled the last 50 of its 800 workers from the Kaesong Industrial Complex. This is an area of factories that's just inside North Korea, on the North Korean side of the demilitarized zone. It's been a symbol of cooperation between North and South Korea. It's also a source of much needed foreign currency for the North. These were the last 50, as I mentioned. As of last week, there were about 125 workers in that complex. South Korea had issued an ultimatum to North Korea, saying that the two sides should get together and talk about this after North Korea pulled 53,000 workers from the complex on April 3rd. So this is an ongoing battle between the two sides, and it raises worries that that the two sides could be spiraling into a more hostile back and forth.
Kenji, tell us a little bit more about how Kaesong operates. There are, about 120 or so South Korean companies who use North Korean and South Korean workers. If all the South Korean workers go, what will be the consequences for the South Korean companies who clearly will be out of pocket?
Absolutely. There are about 140 companies, from what I was able to determine. These companies make all sorts of products, and they have been a major employer of North Korean workers. The insurance claims will be huge on the for the South Korean companies. And yes, as you mentioned, because these companies are able to make products with low-cost wage workers from the North, they will be losing quite a bit from this pullout. This is, incidentally, the first time that the South has actually completely pulled out its workers from this complex. The last couple of times when there was talk that this might happen was back in 2010. When a South Korean naval vessel was sunk, and it was believed to have been done by a North Korean submarine. And then the second time when an island that is very close to the North Korea was shelled by the North and killed a couple of South Korean military officials.
Well, they were talking about those South Korean companies and how they're going to be affected. But really, it is the North Korean workers that are going to really feel the brunt of this effect. Some $90 million in their wages for roughly 54,000 employees will essentially be cut off. There'll be roughly 200,000 to 300,000 dissatisfied people living on that border with South Korea. How bad of a situation will this be for the North Koreans that are barely getting by as it is?
That's right. I mean, if you look at North Korea's economy, it's in a dire state. As you mentioned, about $90 million in cash is generated by the complex every year. Just to put this into context, North Korea makes about $100 million a year exporting weapons. And so this is a major, major source of income for the North and for its workers. At this point, it's not clear how the two will proceed.
Kenji, let's move on to a story that will be making the headlines for the rest of the week, no doubt, which is the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's trip to Moscow. The first visit for a decade a Japanese head of state. We have President Putin on the one hand, who's being very nationalistic. We have Shinzo Abe on the other. The two men have an awful lot of problems to sort out, don't they?
They do, they do. This meeting is going to be about a lot of different issues. It will be about improving relations, energy, business, territory, and regional security. They have a lot of ground to cover. As you mentioned, this is the first summit for the two sides in about a decade. They have met on the sidelines of multilateral meetings, such as APEC in Vladivostok last year. Then Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda actually met with President Vladimir Putin. But this is the first time that they have actually decided to set aside their differences and meet for a summit. This time, Abe will be traveling with a 120-member business delegation representing 40 companies. The hope is that they will be able to seal some deals with Russian companies during the trip. Also on the agenda is territory. Russia, islands that Russia calls the Kurils, they're called the Northern Territories in Japan. They were seized by the then Soviet Union after just days before Japan surrendered during World War II. This has been an issue that has prevented the two sides from reaching a peace accord, ending hostilities during World War II.
Kenji, let's go behind the headlines here and try to look at the real, you know, the behind-the-scene reasons why these two leaders are now meeting in Moscow. What's your sense? Is there a sense that Japan is trying to make a switch away from other countries that it has relied heavily on in terms of trade, like China? Or what's the real impetus that is making these two leaders finally meet?
It's a good question. Some analysts think that this is Japan's attempt to diversify its economic options, to give itself sort of an alternative to China, which is Japan's biggest trading partner. At the same time, it's Japan striking out to look for more sources of energy. Russia is potentially a huge source of natural gas. Japan is the world's largest importer of liquefied natural gas. And so Russia is keen to get in on that business. Japan is keen to find other sources. There's also this issue of, territory that we've talked about in the past. The two sides clearly will not be expecting a breakthrough right away, but this does signal a thawing of chilly relations between the two sides, and it could suggest that there's more sort of business cooperation to come. So this is quite a big step for the two sides.
Kenji, let's move on to a story which is the extension of financial aid to firms that develop these low-cost nursing care robots that are about 800 euros, about 100,000 Japanese yen. Why are they extending this program when in the past there's been quite an awful lot of complaint from the elderly themselves, who say they would much prefer flesh and blood than to electronic to look after them?
Absolutely. The problem is that Japan has a chronic shortage of nursing care workers. And you know, this is a problem that will only get worse as Japan's society grays and you see more people, more elderly people around looking for facilities. At this point, Japan needs an estimated 2 million nursing care workers, but the actual number of workers is around 1.3 million. And then by 2025, the government expects that Japan will actually need 4 million workers. So under this new plan, which is expected to be in a growth plan that's announced in June, the government will extend financial aid to companies that develop these low-cost nursing care robots. And it's mainly targeting four kinds of robots. There's a motorized robot suit, which would assist workers in lifting or moving bedridden patients. A robot that actually helps, it's sort of a walk assist, a self-cleaning robot toilet, and a monitoring robot, which would be able to track the movements of patients suffering from dementia. All of these subsidies are likely to total about 2.4 billion Japanese yen, which is about 19 million euros. The problem in the past has been that Japanese companies have been developing these nursing care robots for decades now, but they've been too expensive to use, too expensive to buy. And under sort of government revisions to nursing care insurance coverage, companies will be able to rent these for much lower cost. So hopefully we'll see a spread of these robots, and possibly, you know, Japan could use this as a major export in the future.
It is a fascinating story indeed. I foresee a future full of robots, cities of robots.
Thank you.
It's a bit scary. That was Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall. Thanks very much.
Coming up on today's episode of Midori House, Italy finally gets a new government. How long will it last?
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme. From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchner.
In London. Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keep an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 9:18 in Rome. It is 8:18 here in London. Now, the swearing-in of Italy's government was overshadowed this weekend by a man called Luigi Preiti. Without a job, separated from his wife, he's been described as a man with nothing more to lose. So as the political deadlock in Rome was being broken indoors, outside the Prime Minister's office, Signor Preiti opened fire with a pistol, intending to attack Italy's politicians. He ended up wounding two police officers.
Signor Preiti is perhaps a living product of Italy's woes. When the country went to the polls in February, most expected chaos, but nobody really foresaw a mess that would leave Europe's third biggest economy ungoverned and ungovernable for almost 2 months. But the creation of a new government has been difficult. It took Giorgio Napolitano, the 87-year-old president, returned to power last week after another mess of an election, to bash the party's heads together. Well, to assess this, we're joined by Serena Danna, who's digital media editor from the Corriere della Sera, and Bill Emmett, who's former former economist, editor and author of the book Good Italy, Bad Italy. Welcome to the programme to you both. I'll start with you, Serena. Have the people of Italy this morning jumped out of bed full of enthusiasm that they have a wonderful new grand coalition of a government? Or has everybody woken up wondering, like a bad hangover, wondering what on earth we've all just signed ourselves up for?
Good morning. Well, actually, I don't think that, you know, Italian people are enthusiastic about the new government. I don't think that, you know, they finally got a government, so today they can go work and, I mean, say goodbye to the children, thinking that maybe something can change in the country. But I think that, I mean, we lost also the, I don't know, I think that we will see. Everyone is very care about the new government, because we know that there is so much job to do, so many things to do. And of course, the new government has some interesting and new things, like, for instance, the number of women or the average that is pretty low comparing to the other governments, because I think that now the average is 53 years old, and with the Monti's government was like 64. So we have 7 women, and I mean, we have a new premier that is a very concrete man, and he knows that, I mean, he has to work a lot. We know, you know, you have seen what's happened yesterday, and what's happened yesterday, it's because of the terrible also climate that we have in the country. So we know that the most important priority is tackling the country's, I think, 11.6% unemployment rate, which has pushed many young Italians to leave the country. So, well, there is so much job to do.
And Bill, let's head to you now to talk a bit about the economics. This came the same day as Greece's parliament announced that it was going to lay off 15,000 state employees. PM Letta has already said that austerity is no longer sufficient. But if he's not going to be willing to make these cuts, he can't obviously keep spending. What's the alternative? What's the way forward?
Well, regrettably, I think that the way forward is going to be a new set of elections within a year, because this government is the product of a political stalemate amid economic despair. The economic despair that's led to many suicides, that led to this Calabrian unemployed man doing his awful, crazy thing outside the Prime Minister's office yesterday, but a despair that led to the stalemate of the February 25th election, which brought in the new opposition, the Five Star Movement, with an amazing 25% of the vote demanding change. The difficulty economically is that there's very little scope for Enrico Letta's government to bring change, because of disagreements between left and right that are in this grand coalition, and because of interest groups that all say, yes, you should cut somebody's public spending, but not mine. You should open up somebody's market or profession or sector, but please not mine. So I think that there is not yet a consensus for reform, even though this government is, as Serena Danna says, symbolically a new start.
Bill, just staying with you for a moment, you talk about the absence of a consensus for reform. In the past, you've written about two kinds of Italy's, one which has a cooperative instinct, your so-called good Italy, and then also the bad Italy, the acquisition of power to further oneself, which is symptomatic of the Berlusconi time. Given the fact that we have this very shaky experiment of a coalition, which do you think's going to win out?
Well, at the moment, still the bad Italy is dominant. In the name of the documentary film that I made with the director Annalisa Pieris, my girlfriend, Italy, is in a coma. And the coma needs people to call to wake it up. And unfortunately, the bad Italy remains, I think, predominant. But the cry of despair from the February election was a cry from those in the good Italy, I believe, who want change. So I think there is a beginning of a political process, cultural process for change, but it's amid a terribly difficult economic situation, one which cannot be turned around by a government that is full of incompatibles and that will therefore require new elections to resolve the issues.
Serena, I just want to build on that point, which Bill was mentioning, how we're slowly starting to see that change happen in Italy. But if we go by what happened in the last election, many people voted for Beppe Grillo for that very reason. They were expecting change, but his party was unwilling to negotiate, unwilling to form any kind of a coalition. So do you think Italians will now start to push away some of those feelings of change because they just feel like nothing will be done and they have to go back to the old ways?
Well, actually, first of all, I think that finally Beppe Grillo can relax himself because, you know, at a certain point it seemed that he had to build something, I mean, to join the government. So now that he's finally at the opposition, he can do, I mean, he can do the only thing that he can do, I mean, to stay, to scream against Italy and to scream against the parliament. I think that it depends. I mean, if the new government is, it will be, I mean, will be good on reforms, on taxes, on unemployment, on fixing the electoral law. So at the next election, Beppe Grillo, I mean, if the new government will not fix anything, I think that Beppe Grillo will win much more than in the last election. So I don't know. I think that it really depends on the job of the new government, and it's very difficult. As Bill Emmott said, of course it's a good starting point, but anyway it's very difficult for left and right to work together. We tried in the past several times, and it's very, very difficult. So if they can do the important reforms that the country really needs, the new election will be, I mean, very bad for Beppe Grillo. On the contrary, he will win also the next election.
Serena Dana there, digital media editor at Corriere della Sera, and Bill Emmett, former economist, editor, and author of Good Italy, Bad Italy. Thanks very much for joining us on the program.
From London
to New York,
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. Now, this week on Culture, Rob Bound has been in L.A. for Paris Photo, the French art fair all about photography, which has extended its range from the Grand Palais to Paramount Studios, along with a few sideshows along the way as well.
Rob was invited to one of John Lautner's L.A. buildings, the Sheets Goldstein residence. It's a concrete palace of impossible angles, cantilevered out from the Hollywood Hills. Inside was a French collaboration, curator François Perrin, artist Xavier Vellon, and one half of the French band Nicolas Godin intervened in this amazing space to make sculpture with a soundtrack. Rob spoke to the curator François Perrin, who's a French expat living in LA, whose love of space got him out west.
This house to me is very exceptional. I would say it's my favorite house in LA. It's the Sheets Goldstein residence by John Lautner, built in 1960. And John Lautner is this architect who studied with Frank Lloyd Wright, so he's part of that kind of organic school of architecture where each house fits within the landscape, within its environment. And this one is quite dramatic, like sitting on the top of the hills in Beverly Hills, overlooking the whole city, and being almost like kind of a modern cave or grotto, where basically you don't see the house too much from the outside, but you more experience the outside from the inside. And so it's quite a privilege to be able to do this project in this house, you know.
And do you find that with this house and perhaps other exceptional houses in LA that people are keen to show off the places, as private as people are, if they've got a jewel like this that they want certain people at least to see them?
Well, it's very diverse. Jim Goldstein, who owns this house, he really likes to share that house. He bought the house 40 years ago. He's maybe the second or third owner of the house. And he's been working on the house for the last 30 years. First with John Lautner when he was still alive, and now with Lautner's like former assistant, and has been doing an incredible job, you know, being able to keep that structure in good shape, but also extending it. He's building now extension outside of the house, and he's really, you know, this kind of example of person that helps, you know, like conserve architecture, but make it move forward at the same time.
And as an architect and as a curator, do you feel that this is a house that lends itself to putting on a show? Or does Xavier's work, it obviously echoes some of the lines of the house, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the work that Xavier produced for this exhibition is very specific, but that's the whole series Architecton is about investing like different architecture that we selected with Xavier and create like artwork like specific to it. So the project started last summer at the Neutra House in Silver Lake and continued at the Case Study 21 in Hollywood. And this is the third installment of the series. And every house was different and create like different work. Here, it's pretty much about the kind of the story of the owner, but also the geometry of the house and the vegetation that surrounds it.
So there's a lot to riff off if you're of a creative mind, whether you're an architect, a curator, an artist, or because Nicolas obviously composed some music for it, a composer. There's a lot to go on in a house like this. There's a lot of secrets it feels like it holds. For an artist, there's a lot to explore, perhaps.
The place, I've seen like a lot of amazing party, an amazing visitor as the
there's some pretty good pictures here, right?
In the wall kind of shows. But in the case of the music, Nicolas looks at every house in his own way and produce a music for it. Me as an architect, I have my own references and my own interest also in the background of the architect who did the house, and we try to address that also in the exhibition through some of the artwork or the sculpture. So there's like a sculpture of Lautner in the bedroom overlooking the city, which kind of echo like a photograph of the architect visiting the site during construction. And so, you know,
it's like a bit of a friendly ghost there.
Yeah, it's a kind of an homage, and but also a site-specific sculpture, and that's the idea of the whole project. Is Xavier is a well-known artist in France, in Europe, has been showing for decades in museums and galleries, and this is a kind of a new turn. But also me as an architect and curator, I'm very much interested by this idea of escaping from the white cube of the gallery or the museum. Because when you create there, like everything's possible, it's an abstract space. And so, you know, there's no constraint. And as an architect, I'm used to work with constraint, and making an exhibition in a house create like a whole different type of project where suddenly you cannot do everything you want. I mean, you have a lot of possibilities, but somehow you have to respond to the house, you have to respond to the environment, give like more kind of boundaries to the artist, but at the same time maybe become more creative.
That was François Perrin, who's curator of the Architectones at Jim Goldstein's place in Los Angeles, with Robert Bound. For this week's edition of Culture, to hear from the artist of the exhibition that they were talking about there, Xavier Vélan, tune in tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 2100 hours time if you're in Istanbul.
And in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be reviewing the Finnish papers with Monocle's Markus Hippi, and we'll see who came away as the big winners at the Theatre World's Olivia Awards. But for all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The senior US Senator John McCain, who was the Republican presidential candidate in 2008, has said that a group of nations should get troops ready to invade Syria in order to secure possible stocks of chemical weapons falling into the hands of Islamic militants. A human rights lawyer who represents 17 Guantanamo Bay detainees says the number of inmates on hunger strike has risen to nearly 130. David Reams says the US military had previously denied any hunger strike, but has now acknowledged that it is happening. The parents of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects have abandoned plans to travel to the US to see their surviving son. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's father told Reuters that he and his wife have retreated to a village in southern Russia to avoid the limelight. Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan has condemned last week's attack on the French embassy as an attack on Libya and its leadership. He said there was no doubt that those responsible wanted to stop Libya's progress. 10 seamen are missing after 2 cargo ships collided off southwestern Greece. All the missing men are from one of the ships which sank in the collision about 75 nautical miles off the island of Sapienza. The Dutch Prime Minister said that a monarch is important for national continuity and allows people to confront the real government. Mark Rutte was speaking as he welcomed international media ahead of Queen Beatrix's abdication and the investiture of her son, Crown Prince Willem-Alexander, on Tuesday. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House, so the time here in London is 8:35 a.m. now. I am surrounded by theatre experts and enthusiasts because we can talk about a 15-year-old teenager with Asperger syndrome, the Queen, and a psychotic barber, all three connected by the fact that they were winners at last night's Olivier Awards here in London.
And the West End was a flurry of excitement as tuxedos and ball gowns graced the red carpet in Covent Garden, and it was the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime that came away with the most awards. Well, joining us now in the studio is Matt Wolfe, the International Herald Tribune's theatre critic and Monocle regular. He swapped his tux for a bit more normal clothes. Matt, thanks for coming in.
I'm quite disappointed, Matt, that you don't dress up to come in, frankly.
You're lucky I didn't show up in my nightshirt.
Make an effort, please.
We'll do.
Phil and I are in full evening dress here, especially.
Yes, it's very glam.
Well, we heard it there. It was the curious incident of the dog in the night that came away as the big winner, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It's interesting that last year there were 7 awards that went to the musical Matilda. This year there were 7 awards that went to this play, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It used to be that the Olivier's sort of parceled out the awards very kind of democratically across a whole range of shows. After all, this isn't Cleveland, you know. London does have lots and lots of shows that open each season in contention. But I'm beginning to get the impression, for various reasons, perhaps commercially, that there's an interest now in not sharing the wealth. In other words, it's quite nice to have a sweep. So Matilda last year, Curious Incident this year.
Why is that? I mean, one automatically thinks that of the export potential of a show.
Well, that look what the hottest show is now on Broadway, which is Matilda, with 7 Olivier Awards trumpeted all the way to New York. And of course, Curious Incident has been eyeing New York ever since it moved to the West End. I think that has a lot to do with it. It makes very good headlines. They've also changed how the voting procedure happens with the Olivier's. It's now much, much more like the Tony Awards on Broadway, i.e. it used to just be a select panel of 8 or 9 people, kind of decided everything, the short list, the long list, the winners. Now they still have the panel, but they fold in the industry. And as soon as you fold in the industry, there's going to be that commercial concentration.
And now let's talk a bit about the acting awards. Luke Treadaway came away as the big winner for Curious Incident. He beat Rupert Everett in Judas Kiss and James McAvoy in Macbeth. Do you think it was a well-deserved win, or do you think it should have gone to someone else?
Well, it was really sweet to see Luke Treadaway win it. He has literally sweated blood for that show. I mean, quite literally. And he's been with it since its inception at the National Theatre Studio all the way through. He's intensely devoted to the work of Marion Elliott, the director. So that was quite nice. I thought going in that Rupert Everett would win because The Judas Kiss, in which he played Oscar Wilde, has been a project near and dear to his heart. He got the best reviews of his career. He'll never have a chance to do it again, probably. So I was a little bit surprised, but clearly there was an unstoppable momentum for Luke. On the actress side, Helen Mirren seems to pick up trophies every time she plays.
She can't
plays.
Go wrong if she plays.
No.
She had great hair last night.
Her hair was extraordinary.
It was gravity-defying.
And she, of course, having won a BAFTA and an Oscar for playing HRH, of course, on screen 6 or 7 years ago, is now racking up trophies for playing the same role in a different context on stage. And she does it just beautifully. I was slightly disappointed that Hattie Morahan didn't win for her extraordinary performance in A Doll's House, but that was a small off-West End show. And as I say, there seemed to be a great impetus to give it to the West End big boys.
Well, you say that, but you mentioned the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Now, that started off at the smallest one. It was at Cottesloe, and then it transferred. And we've seen a lovely flow, such as I'm thinking of perhaps Warhorse and what was that very, very funny one? One Man, Two Governors, which then went and flew in New York.
Right.
This actually really sort of heartens me.
Well, yes. And in fact, one of the themes of the night, which may be lost perhaps on the general observer, was this kind of tension between the not-for-profit theatre, the subsidized theatre, and the West End. Curious Incident is a very good example of going from success in one to success in the other. Marion Elliott, the director, was amongst those who pointed out that if you squeeze the subsidy off at its base, i.e. the National Theatre, you then don't get the commercial success that follows. So we'll see if Maria Miller et al. Are listening.
And it was Matilda that won 7 awards last year, the musical Matilda. This year, Top Hat, I think it was the top billing musical. Was that well-deserved?
Well, the fact of the matter is that last year, 2012, was an incredibly thin year for musicals. There was really one great musical production in London during 2012, which was the revival of Sweeney Todd, and that came away deservedly with 3 wins. On the new musical front, there were only 5 that were eligible. Of the 5 that were eligible, 4 got nominated. The one that didn't was a show you may have heard about called Viva Forever. that got left.
I know
at
that's
the,
a personal favorite.
Yeah,
of yours.
Oh,
People said you'd rather chew your own arm off than see that again.
I can't wait to see it again this afternoon. I'll have a special matinee in my honor. But
you'd be the only one in the audience.
But for Best Musical, it really was a face-off between 2 not very good shows, Top Hat and The Bodyguard. And of those 2, I would have given it to Top Hat. So,
Why do you think it was so thin last year? I mean, a lot of people were mentioning the O word.
Very, very particular reason. It was the O word and, of course, all the festivities surrounding the Queen. And the Olivier's this time next year will be musicals rich because 2013 is having 12, 13, 14 major musical productions. We're having the overkill this year to compensate for the absence last year. So Top Hat, I guess, the best of a not very interesting bunch. It also won a couple of other awards, including for its choreography, which is very nice, and for its costumes.
You sound, I hate to say it, a little ho-hum about last night's award.
Well, I just think that given the quantity and the quality of what London offers, it's very odd to give all the prizes to 5 shows, which is really what it boiled down to. When you think of the amazing stuff the Royal Court did last year that wasn't recognized, the stuff the Donmar did, other things that the National did, like James Graham's terrific plays, This House, which hasn't transferred to the West End. What would have been interesting would be to honor some of the subsidized theater shows that stayed put at their particular addresses. But I really do think that it's about sort of ticking commercial boxes.
And that's why you think it's the switch towards a similar style to the Tony Awards.
Well, a lot of that was there in the presentation. There were bits from Matthew Morrison, the Glee star Idina Menzel from Broadway's Wicked. It felt like the Tonys. There were all these kind of big musical numbers, many of which had nothing to do with the event at hand. They were just fun. And I think that's what the Oliviers want, is they want to be more fun.
And just very quickly, the Audience Award, this is the award that the people are allowed to vote for. This year it went to Billy Elliot, a friend of mine's actually in that production.
Right.
But they were all shocked that they kind of came away as the winner.
Well, what was interesting about that is Billy Elliot's been running, 8 years or something like that. And it's a nice boost when you're that far into a long run. Who knows how long it'll continue to run? I don't think it's going to be another Phantom of the Opera and run a quarter century. I may be wrong. The young Billy, who did the number for the crowd in Covent Garden Piazza, was absolutely delightful and had this wonderful sort of arms thrown aloft at the end of his song. And I thought, this guy is a stayer. He's going to be a star.
Matt Wolff, as ever, thank you very much indeed. Matt Wolff, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, to be often found at the queue for Viva Forever. You're listening to Midori House. It's just coming up to 8:43 a.m. here in London. We head to Ramallah in just a moment.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
Monocle are excited to announce the arrival of our newest space in London. on Marylebone's Chilton Street, the Monocle Café will be serving a selection of pastries from Lanka, the finest freshly ground coffee from Allpress to get you through the day, and more besides. So, if you're looking to break up a day's shopping or start the day with a meeting and a great cup of coffee, pop along to the Monocle Café on Chilton Street, Marylebone, London, 7 days a week.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. The time is 9:44 in Ramallah, which is where we're going to head to now, to get a check of the stories making the headlines in Israel and Palestine.
Our correspondent Joseph Dana is our man on the ground there, and he's on the line. Welcome to the show, Joseph. Let's begin with this ongoing saga to do with the flotilla compensation case. It now appears, that the Israeli Defence Force soldiers involved on the raid on the Mavi Marmara will now not face criminal charges.
That's exactly right. And this has really been the most important kind of sticking point for Israel because, you know, former chiefs of the IDF were actually on trial in Turkey. And this raises a lot of very serious legal obstacles. And so it looks as though the Turks are going to be able to pass a very kind of curious government law that will supersede authority from local courts in Istanbul and alleviate this issue. And the next round of talks will happen sometime this week, likely in Jerusalem. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this is that they really kind of have to get the ball rolling because both prime ministers of Israel and Turkey have some very important commitments coming up. And so if they don't sign an agreement now, they might not have a chance to sign one in the next couple of months. And so that's really the external pressure on the discussions right now.
And Joseph, when they do or if they do come to an agreement, what do you foresee the relationship between Turkey and Israel going forward?
I see the relationship becoming that much more kind of warm in the economic and especially energy sphere. You know, as we've discussed a little bit on Monocle, Turkish Airlines has played a very curious role in all of this. The Israeli kind of public is using Istanbul as one of its major aviation hubs. And I think that this kind of relationship, this kind of very strange soft power aviation relationship will very much continue. I don't think we're going to see droves of Israeli tourists in Bodrum anytime soon, but I think that is in the works. And there's a certain natural partnership that exists between these two countries. And in a couple of months' time, it's going to be right on track.
Joseph, you mentioned there that there's a sense of urgency to getting an agreement sorted with these talks. One of the reasons is perhaps because the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan is heading to Washington and he clearly needs to be seen to be putting on a friendly face towards Israel. How much good do you think this will do Turkey on the international stage?
I think it's doing Turkey very good on the international stage. Not only is the Turkish Prime Minister going to Washington, and Washington, specifically the Secretary of State, John Kerry, has played an enormously kind of positive role, you know, shuttling between Ankara and Jerusalem to make sure that these peace negotiations kind of really, really take shape. Not only is that happening, but the Turks are also very respected in the Palestinian kind of arena as well. And there are rumors, or at least the Turks are saying that the Prime Minister will be visiting Gaza at the end of the month. And so that's another reason why these talks between Israel and Turkey really must have to, you know, kind of be signed, because the Gaza situation will throw another kind of wrench in the situation. And it demonstrates Turkey's soft power in the region of really playing with all sides and being a moderating force.
And Joseph, now let's head over to Jerusalem. That city is developing a light rail project, but the route is causing quite a bit of controversy.
Right. Well, the light rail has actually come into existence. It's a quite amazing train. I mean, it's better fitted for the streets of Berlin than Jerusalem per se. But the problem with it, or at least the kind of controversy about it, is that the municipality has sent the line deep into the occupied eastern part, the Palestinian part of Jerusalem. And the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, along with some kind of pro-Palestinian French activists, actually filed a court case against the French firms that were involved in the creation of the rail because of this line. And so last week we had a Paris court actually rule that these French firms were not in any sort of violation of international law. And it's very curious to see a French court, you know, ruling on an infrastructure project inside of Jerusalem that's very pivotal in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But it does demonstrate the kind of desperation that a lot of Palestinian groups have at this ongoing entrenchment of Israeli control, you know, kind of taking shape in Jerusalem and in the West Bank as a whole.
It is quite astonishing that people are being bound by a decision which is taking place several hundred miles away. Can you see this being as a bit of a precedent?
I think that we will see somewhat of a precedent. I mean, this is an ongoing relationship that the European Union and European member states have with this Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in which civil society groups in Europe have become very vocal over the last couple of years about their real anger with Israeli policies. And so you see this frustration among these civil society groups, and they're taking it to local courts with the intention or the hope to apply some sort of pressure on Israel. Now, this was really a very high-profile case in which they went after these French firms. And the fact that the French court system has kind of rejected this claim is going to set a certain precedent. I don't think that it will stop or curtail this kind of flood of activism in Europe, but it definitely shows that not all of the kind of European government sectors are willing to kind of go along with this this anger that the civil society apparently has.
And Joseph, you briefly touched upon closer energy ties between Turkey and Israel. Israel wanting to export more of its natural resources, but there's environmental groups within Israel that are hoping to put a stop to that.
Absolutely. The Israeli natural gas finds, which have now they found the gas in 2008, but now the gas is actually kind of pumping into Israel. This gas has really become a game changer in Israeli politics. During the last election, which happened in last January, there was a number of, you know, the election was typified by economic issues and by the kind of pains of the middle class in Israeli society. And all of a sudden, we have this flood of, no pun intended, of natural gas going into the society, which could really be an engine for some serious cash growth in the society. And yet, it's all kind of happening in this very nefarious kind of backdoor way. And so last week, a Knesset committee of a number of basically left-wing Knesset parties actually filed a letter to the parliament speaker saying that these decisions about how natural gas is going to be taken out of the ground, the environmental concerns, and how the money is going to be spent has to be coming in front of the parliament and can't be in these kind of backdoor government, closed-door meetings and things like that. And so we see the natural gas playing a very important role internationally with the relations between Israel and Turkey, and also domestically in terms of how this money is going to be spent and the environmental impact that it could have. And it's really an ongoing kind of conversation that should take place over the next several years.
Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana on the line for us from Ramallah. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn. And in a moment, Marcus Hippie, looking neat as a pin this morning in a lovely fresh shirt, will be coming to bring us the best of the Nordic newspapers. Taking us there, this is from Copenhagen, Efterklang and Modern Drift. Just a little touch of Efterklang there with Modern Drift.
Time now to welcome Monocle's Marcus Hippie to the studio to review this morning's Nordic front pages. Welcome to the show, Marcus.
Thank you. Hello, Phil.
How are you? Did you have a good weekend?
I'm very good. I had a great weekend.
Excellent. Look splendid.
Very healthy and chirpy.
Yeah, I think shirt is very nice this morning.
Yeah, unfortunately we're not on television.
Sorry?
What do you have for us? One of the stories with Nokia, I know they're unveiling a brand new Lumia phone in the middle of May here in the UK, but some news, they've struck a bit of a deal.
Yeah, according to reports, they have actually made quite a significant deal in the US with an American operator, Verizon Wireless, and this means that their new Lumia phones are going to be more widely available in the US than pretty much ever before. which is, for once, positive news. I don't actually remember when there would have been anything positive about Nokia during the last 2-3 years. And, well, this actually lifts the spirits in Finland. Many people have been sacked already, many people have lost their jobs, and people kind of feel like Nokia is the thing of the past. It's been kind of widely accepted in Finland. But who knows? Maybe Nokia could even get back to track.
They've certainly sold the family silver in many respects. They've sold a lot of their land, haven't they, in Finland, and also sort of consolidating their bases elsewhere. What makes me scratch my head slightly, though, is that why on earth would they want to launch a phone at the time when Samsung is doing its best to completely dominate the smartphone market? The BlackBerry 10 is out, and that again is trying to change the way that people use their phones. And suddenly you get the impression that Nokia is just limping behind, saying, "No, look at our phone; it's brilliant."
Exactly. There's also been reports regarding the CEO of Nokia, Stephen Ellop, that, you know, if he doesn't get Nokia back on track, say during the following year, it's time for him to go, because many people feel like Nokia does not have a clear strategy on what they want.
And another story regarding Finland's security intelligence services. It looks like they're getting a bit more money and hiring a few more spies, perhaps.
It is a very interesting development in Finland. Say, 20 years ago, no one really even knew that there was such thing as Finnish security intelligence services. And it's been growing during the years. And for some reason, all of a sudden now, they're going to get a significant increase in their resources. The resources are going to be increased by 1/5, which means there's going to be loads more staff, flows of more money available. That doesn't, according to reports, that doesn't mean that there would be a greater threat of terrorism in Finland, but this is about international tendencies. They've been watching what's been going on in neighboring countries, what's been going on in, say, Norway. And dramatic cases there. And, you know, in Sweden, there's been some minor terrorism. And according to numbers, in Europe last year, there was more terrorist attacks than actually ever before.
Is there any indication, this is me jumping madly to conclusions, so please stop me, that the fact that they're so close to Russia, that might have something to do with the fact, and, you know, we all love a good Russian spy.
I don't think actually there's a connection.
Fine, that's all I need to know.
We are going through the Nordic news, so actually let's talk about something that all the Nordic countries are talking about at the same time. May Day, Varbuk's Day, is approaching. The 1st of May is a massive celebration in all those countries. And, well, people have been kind of curiously waiting for the weather forecasts, you know, letting them know what's actually happening.
And?
It's going to be quite miserable. It's going to be quite cold.
Oh, Marcus.
But the spring is coming. There's been a very exciting story developing in the Finnish Gulf. There's been an ice float. 20 people went ice hole fishing.
Yes.
And then, you know, all of a sudden they realise there's no way of getting back to the land.
Well,
and
they all have
phones. For the last 24 hours, we basically followed how on earth they're going to get back.
Oh, really?
Helicopter.
Have there been? They
had to be rescued.
That's the latest. We have a finite number of ideas here. We have train, no. Car, perhaps not. Helicopter and boat, perhaps. Is this a rare occurrence, the ice float?
I don't remember having seen anything similar before. So, yeah, but I'm glad there was a happy ending for this.
Well, there is a happy ending. They're not still out there.
They are not still out there.
We can end this programme on a happy note then. Thank you very much indeed, Monocle's Marcus Hippie, of course. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Ella John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Annabelle Bly, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Phil Hunt will be back in the hot seat. He'll be joined by Dom Reynolds tomorrow to bring you Midori House at the same time at 8 a.m. London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks
for
listening.
Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.